Meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are holding remote hearings pursuant to House Rule 10.01. One thing that I did want to do this morning is I do want to just take a moment and really recognize how difficult the last 2 weeks have been for many members and for staff, given the violence that has occurred in DC and throughout our country. And just want to recognize this moment that we're in, 10 months, 11 months into the pandemic, and how heavy everything can be. And so I just wanted to sort of recognize that and encourage folks to reach out to others for support and remind staff and members that we have an employee assistance program that is available to folks if they need it. So I just wanted to take a second to acknowledge that, because it is a unique, challenging time that we're in. And with that, we will go to the roll. Anna, if you could take the roll, please go ahead.
Okay. Chair Becker Fenn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel. Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Present.
And Representative Grossel.
All right, thank you, Anna. We do have a quorum present, so we'll get started. So today we've got two presentations on two different topics. First, from the Department of Administration on Chapter 13 and data practices, and we also have Min Koji is here to present briefly as well, and then we'll move on to the Department of Human Rights. I do want to make sure we approve the minutes from last week. Vice Chair Mueller, do I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 14th, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Well, hopefully people have had time to take a look. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes are adopted. And with that, we will move on to the first presentation. I just want to make sure they have been let into the Zoom room.
We are here.
All right. So if you want to get started, please identify yourself for the record and state who you're with, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, good morning. My name is Taya Moxley-Goldsmith. I am the Acting Director of the Data Practices Office, and with me today is Stacey Christensen. Give her an opportunity. Let's see, I think she's here.
Good morning.
All right, I am going to share my screen here and get going. I know there is a range of experience, data practices experience on this committee. For some of you, this will probably be a high level refresher. And for others, I hope that this is a good introduction. I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about data practices today. I wanted to start with just a little bit more about who we are and what we do. We are a small office at the Department of Administration. We are just three people currently, and we're a statewide resource on data practices and open meeting law. The bulk of what we do really is respond to questions related to those two laws, both from government and members of the public, and that's going to include the media and the legislature as well. We also help the Commissioner of Administration with her responsibilities, and that includes issuing non-binding advisory opinions. And we have over 1,000 advisory opinions now, and they're all on our website. We did a lot at the beginning of the opinion authority, which was back in the early 90s. We do fewer now. We found that it's more efficient to kind of pursue informal resolution, and we're able to resolve a lot of issues that way rather than going through the formal several month process to do advisory opinions. We also help the Commissioner of Administration with her responsibilities to issue temporary classifications of data. Those are less common. We probably have fewer than one a year of those. And we help with data challenge appeals, and that relates to a data subject's right to challenge the accuracy and completeness of data about themselves, and then they have the opportunity to appeal that determination to the Department of Administration. And so we help the Commissioner with that. We also have a website, and we send out a newsletter every other month. So if you're interested in learning more about advisory opinions that are issued or case law, you can certainly sign up for our newsletter. We are also on Twitter and have a YouTube channel. And actually, there are a lot of great resources on our YouTube channel. You'll find narrated PowerPoints, and we have recorded webinars as well. And so you can find those on our YouTube channel, and I'll give you that information towards the end. We also provide legislative assistance because our community partners include both the government and members of the public. We really try to stay neutral and stay in the middle of any sort of policy discussions. We really leave those determinations up to you to make. And so if a member of the public comes to us and says, you know, I'm really interested in making all copy costs free, I don't want to pay for copies of government data, we would say, okay, this is how you could go about doing that. This is some sample language you could try. Here's some resistance you might face. And similarly, if government came to us and said, you know, I'd really like to make all paper copies a dollar a piece, we would have the same kind of conversation with them. So unless it really directly affects the operation of our office, we try to stay neutral in terms of the policy determinations, but we do provide legislative assistance. We also provide training, and that includes some paid training. We have half day and full day workshops related to data practices and the open meeting law. And we also do free monthly webinars on different topics. Last month we did virtual meetings related to open meeting law. And this month we'll be doing some data practices ones. And I'll highlight a couple other ones a little later in the presentation. And again, those are all recorded and they're put on our YouTube channel. So just jumping into data practices, I have a couple questions just to kind of frame the issue for us. So is an email from your legislative address to a constituent government data that you have to provide to a data requester? And the answer to that question is no. Email from your legislative address that you maintain is not government data because the Minnesota legislature is not subject to the Data Practices Act and does not need to respond to data requests. So that means that you can determine who has access to those kinds of emails on your own. However, is an email that you send to the Data Practices Office staff asking a question about classification government data? And the answer to that one is yes. The email is government data as maintained by the Data Practices Office because Data Practices Office staff are state agency employees and we are subject to the Data Practices Act. So an email about classification of data is generally just going to be public, which means that anyone can have access to it for any reason. And we are obligated by the Data Practices Act to provide access to public data. So we would have to provide that if we were asked. So the Data Practices Act, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, is found in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 13, and basically it regulates how government entities handle government information. Basically, it is trying to maintain the proper balance of these three policy considerations. The first one is the public's right to know about the activities of their government, so that's that accountability and transparency piece. Privacy rights of individuals. As individuals, we have the right of privacy in some of our information. And then the governments need to have and use data to do its work, and I'll add also to do our work efficiently. And so we have that picture of the three-legged stool. That's kind of our visual to show how those rights need to be balanced and how sometimes those rights, as you can tell, have a natural tension. And so some of the interesting data practices issues and the complex data practices issues come where these three policy considerations are coming together and maybe conflicting. So Chapter 13, or the Data Practices Act, in a nutshell, says that all government data are public unless there's a specific statute that makes data not public. right? So we start from the presumption that all government data are public, and there has to be a statute making it not public, right? It also classifies data that are not public, which means there are a lot of classifications throughout Chapter 13 that classify data as not public, but there are a lot of classifications outside of Chapter 13 as well. The reviser has done a great job of trying to include a lot of those cross-references to other sections and other chapters that classify data as well. The law also provides access rights for the public and data subjects, and those rights are slightly different. And so we'll talk about a couple places where those rights are different. And it also requires that data on individuals, and by individual, we mean a living human person, that's defined in the statute, data on individuals are accurate, current, complete, and secure. So there are some requirements around that as well. The Data Practices Act applies to state agencies. So for instance, the Department of Administration, it's also going to apply to the Secretary of State. And for purposes of the Data Practices Act, the University of Minnesota is also considered a state agency. It applies to political subdivisions. So that's going to be school districts and cities and counties, watershed districts, et cetera. It also applies to statewide systems, and that might be a joint powers authority, or it's a record keeping system that multiple government entities use. The Data Practices Act, however, does not apply, as I mentioned, to the legislature. It does not apply to the courts. The courts have their own rules of public access. It does not apply to most non-metro townships. And it does not apply to non-governmental entities, which sounds like a silly thing to include, but we do get questions every now and then about getting access to information from condo associations or homeowner associations, but it does not apply to those kinds of organizations. So, what are government data? I've already used that phrase quite a bit. The law defines it as all data collected, created, received, maintained, or disseminated by any government entity, regardless of its physical form, storage media, or conditions of use. So you can see this is a really broad definition, and it boils down to government information that is recorded. So it does have to be recorded in some way, whether it's on paper, or it's a photograph, or it's a video, or a map. Those are all going to be government data. But if you and I just have a conversation about data practices and nothing is written down, then there's no government data there. It does have to be recorded in some way. And the reason that we use this phrase government data versus government records or open records or some language that maybe other states might use is because data are individual pieces of information. And instead of classifying the four corners of a document, we classify the individual bits of information that make up a document. So we do have the government entities have the obligation to redact out any not public data elements and provide the public elements in a document. So government data are separated out into these two large categories. Somewhat self-explanatory, they're data on individuals and data not on individuals. And again, an individual is a living human person. And so data on individuals are data that identify someone. And so some examples would be a public employee's telephone number, the name and address of an adult arrestee, an athlete of the week photograph. Those are all data on individuals. And then data not on individuals would be data that do not identify someone. So makes and models of fleet trucks, names of companies that are preferred vendors, or lists of government websites. Those are all data not on individuals. Those two broad categories are then broken down into classifications. And this classification scheme is really at the heart of the Data Practices Act. This is the thing that separates our law from pretty much every other law in the United States related to government records and open records. A lot of other states have a freedom of information model similar to the federal government, but here in Minnesota, we have this classification structure. So for data on individuals and data not on individuals, the first classification is public, and that means that it's available to anyone for any reason, as I mentioned. And a couple examples of things that are public are public employees' names and gross salaries. So those are public and anyone can have it for any reason. And if somebody requests that information, they have the right to get access to that. The next classification set of classifications is private data on individuals, and non-public data not on individuals. And those are more restrictive, which means the public does not get access to these. The data subject, the person that it's about, does get access. Those within the entity whose work assignment requires access, so those in government who need it to do their jobs can have access. Entities authorized by law, so if there's statutory authority. And then those authorized by the data subject, and that means that the person has informed consent from the data subject. And some examples of private data would be a public employee's home address or home phone number. Those things are not available to the public, but for instance, if a public employee needed to verify that their employer had the right home address and home phone number, they could certainly get access to it. HR could get access to it to administer the employee's employment, but the public could not have access to it. Another example would be the subject of a complaint when there is no discipline. So for most employees, when we call regular employees, the existence and status of a complaint are always public. So you could know that a certain employee had 3 complaints and 2 are closed and 1 is pending. And that's public. So again, anybody can have it for any reason. But the nature of the complaint is private unless that employee is the subject of final discipline. The next set of classifications is confidential for data on individuals and protected non-public for data not on individuals. And this is the most restrictive classification, which means that the person that it's about doesn't get access to it. Only those in the entity whose work assignment requires access get to access that information, or those who have statutory authority. And this is a fairly limited set of data. There's not a lot of confidential or protected non-public data. But the most common examples are data collected as part of an active civil legal action or an active criminal investigation. So when those investigations are occurring, some of this data is confidential to protect the integrity of that investigation. But generally, after that, the investigation is over, the data will change to a different classification, which might allow the public to get access, or it might allow at least the data subject to get access. So this is a very strict classification, but also fairly narrow. There's not a lot of this kind of data. So what's important to remember is that classification drives and determines access. So sometimes we use the words private and confidential to mean the same thing when we're just talking. But in the data practices context, they have very specific meanings and will restrict access to certain information. So it's important to remember those distinctions. How would you get access to government data maintained by a government entity? You can make a data request. Government entities must have access policies. So every government entity has set of access policies. They usually have 2, one for members of the public and one for data subjects, again, because those rights are a little bit different. And these policies describe the process for obtaining data. So for instance, when we get calls or emails from a data requester who's maybe trying to get some data there, they haven't heard anything from a government entity, we almost always start with trying to locate their access policy so we can see, did the requester send it to the right person? Have they followed the policy and the procedure set out in the policy so that we can help direct them so that they can get data that they're entitled to. So if you need to make a data request, this is also a good place to start, is just locating the government entity's access policies so you know how to make a data request. Once the government entity receives your data request, they have 3 ways that they can respond. One is that they can provide access to the data. If it's public data, then you can have it. If it's private data about you and you verified your identity, then you can have access to it. So one way is just simply to provide access and give copies if you've requested them. The second way is to inform you that the data are classified as not public. So if the data are not public about someone else, or if they're just not public and you can't have access to them, then the government entity has to provide you the exact section, the statutory section, that classifies it as not public. So as I said at the beginning, we start from the basis that everything is public unless there's a specific law making it not public. And when the data are not public, government has to give you that law when they deny access. The third way is to inform you that the data do not exist or are not in the format you requested. So if the data don't exist, then government can't provide it. So that's just one of the responses. The second part of that is if you ask for data that in a Word document, but government maintains it in a PDF. They don't have to create it in a Word document for you. They'll just say, I have it in a PDF and I can provide it to you, but that's how we maintain it. So again, in general, entities are not required to create data to respond to requests, and entities may ask for clarification. And this helps both the entity and the requester just to make sure that the requester is getting the actual data that they want, and also the requester can understand how government maintains the data that they're looking for. Government does have some requirements around response time. And again, here is a one situation where the rights are different for members of the public and for data subjects. And for members of the public who are asking for public data, the response time is appropriate and prompt, a reasonable amount of time. What does that mean? It varies a lot. These are very fact-specific questions based on the size and complexity of the request, what's happening at the entity when they receive the request. Is your request number one in the line, or is it number 200? So this requirement is necessarily flexible for a request that might be, I just want the meeting minutes from last month, which seems like a fairly straightforward request, pretty easy to handle, to I want 10,000 emails. That's a pretty big request. That's going to take a long time. And so this requirement is flexible to sort of accommodate that range of requests. But it varies quite a bit based on the request. For data subjects, there is a typo in the materials I sent. It should be 1304 subdivision 3, which I have right here in your materials. It says subdivision 2. For data subjects asking for data about themselves, it's much more strict. It's immediately if possible, or 10 business days. And I think when the law was originally written, I believe it was 5 business days, but it was changed to 10 business days. And you can see that kind of accommodating. We're thinking about our three-legged stool and balancing those policies for the government's ability to use data and do their job effectively. The government got 5 more days to respond to those requests. Another area where members of the public and data subjects are slightly different are in copy costs. So for both kinds of requesters, if they just want to look at the data and they're not asking government to make them a copy, if they're just looking to inspect, then there's no charge. It's free. Inspection is always free, regardless if it's one email or 10,000 emails. If they just want to look, it's free. We also have some advisory opinions that say that members of the public can use their own equipment. We have an older opinion that had a requester bringing in their own scanner, somebody using their camera. And I think nowadays we would say, you know, you can use your phone and you can take pictures and you're not asking government to make you a copy of that data. So it's free. However, if a data requester asks for government to make a copy, then we are government may charge. It's not required, but they may. And these are the copy cost structures for that. So for members of the public asking for public data, if it's 100 or fewer paper pages, it's 25 cents a page. That's the most they can charge. If it's anything else, it's 101 paper pages. If it's an electronic copy, if it's a photograph, they can charge what are called actual costs. And actual costs are the time it takes to search and retrieve the data, the time to make and transmit the copies, and the materials. So if somebody's getting a CD-ROM or a thumb drive, government can charge for that. They cannot charge for redaction. So government is not allowed to charge for separating public from not public data. And for a lot of government entities, that's where the time comes in. Again, with some of those bigger requests, government has the obligation to protect not public data. And so they have to look through all of the data to make sure that they're redacting appropriately. And then just a note about electronic data. Electronic data is actual costs. So if you have a PDF, even though it's paginated, it might have 10 pages. It's not 25 cents a page. It's just actual costs. So however long it took you to locate that PDF, attach it and send it, that's what government can charge. And all of these things, how copy costs are determined, a lot of times all of these things are also listed in the access policies, so a data requester can be aware of how they might be charged if they ask for copies. A data subject, however, is different. So they don't have that 25 cents a page cost structure. It's actual costs, and actual cost for data subject only means the time to make and transmit and the materials. So there's no charging for search and retrieval. It's a much more limited set of considerations for data subjects. Again, there's no charging to redact. So if they have to redact other people's not public data, then government cannot charge for that. Are there penalties for violating the Data Practices Act? Yes, there are. The Data Practices Act in Section 13.08 provides civil remedies. So there's an action to compel compliance if a data requester thinks they should be able to get access to something and government has said, no, we think this is not public. The data requester can bring an action to compel compliance in district court, and then the judge can take a look at the data in camera and make a decision about the classification. If a data requester has been damaged, they can bring an action for damages, costs, and attorney fees based on an entity's performance of their data practices obligations. There is also an administrative remedy at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Essentially, it's an action to compel compliance within it has to occur within 2 years of the alleged violation. So that can be a slightly quicker way to get in front of a fact finder to make a determination to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings versus going directly to district court. There are also penalties in Section 1309. A willful violation or a breach, if an employee causes a breach, is a misdemeanor. These are pretty rare. It has happened that they are prosecuted, but it's fairly rare. I think much more common for employees are dismissal or suspension. So there may be some HR consequences or personnel consequences for a willful violation or causing a breach. And then finally, we have the advisory opinion authority here. Again, they are non-binding and they don't carry any enforcement authority. The goal is really that they are advisory in nature, but ultimately an entity does not need to follow the conclusions the commissioner reaches in an advisory opinion. The Data Practices Office receives a lot of questions about government data. What types of data do people ask about most frequently? So the two types of data that we get asked about most frequently are personnel data and law enforcement data. And we have all-day workshops on both of those topics. I'm going to try to give you a really brief, broad overview of those two sections. And just to note, we did a series on law enforcement, a webinar series on law enforcement data with 5 parts, and a webinar series on personnel data with 4 parts, and those are on YouTube. So if you want to take a look at them, they're about half an hour a piece. It gives a little bit of a deeper dive, and then you can also see the kinds of questions that we get asked about those two topics. So personnel data, section 13.43. As I started out the presentation, the Data Practices Act starts from the basis that everything is public unless there's a law that makes it not public. 1343 reverses that and says that data about public employees is private unless there's a law making it public. And section 1343 has a very long list of information about public employees that are public, as I mentioned, name, gross salary, employer paid benefits, education and training background, all those kinds of things are public and anybody can get access to those. The two areas that we get a lot of questions about are complaints and discipline. As I mentioned, the existence and status of complaints are always going to be public, so people can always have access to that. In terms of disciplinary actions, for most employees, there are exceptions, but for most employees, if there's final discipline, then the public can find out what the complaint was about, what the discipline was, and why they got disciplined. So it's a very quick, brief 1343 overview. Again, we do an all-day workshop on this. For the other topic that we get a lot of questions about is law enforcement data, and that's in section 1382. And as I mentioned, active criminal investigative data are confidential. That's that strictest classification, meaning that the data subject doesn't get to see it. But certain data are always public, even when that investigation is active. So arrest data, we don't have secret arrests. So when someone is arrested, that information is always going to be public. Request for service data or response or incident data, all of these data elements are always going to be public. And these are basically the who, what, when, where. They're the things that you would find in an incident report. A lot of times somebody might see a police car in their neighborhood and want to know what's happening, and they can go to their local law enforcement and ask for the report, and they can get this information that's listed as public, even if there's an active criminal investigation. I did want to note real quickly that there is a separate section for body camera data, which is in 13.825, but that's also law enforcement data. All right, where do you go for more assistance in understanding the Data Practices Act? Please reach out to us. There, you can email us or call us, and then there are all these variety of other ways that we have to learn more about data practices. We're happy to answer questions. We talk about data practices all day, every day. And so we're happy to talk about it with you or answer any questions you may have. So I appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you today, and I will turn it back over to Chair Becca Finn.
All right, thank you very much. We do have a couple questions. So first on the list is Representative Hollins.
Sorry, struggling to unmute myself. Thanks so much. Thank you so much, Chair. So my question is really around COVID-19 and how you are accommodating requests for inspection during COVID-19. I know when I have done any requests for data inspection. I mean, that's a lot of what regular people do, right? Because we can't afford to do something else or to pay for, the work that comes out. So I'm really interested to know how you are accommodating those requests to make sure that people have access to that information.
Ms. Moxley Goldsmith.
Thank you. Great question. We have talked to when this question arises, we tell government that they still have the obligation to provide access to data and to find a free way to do that, because as you mentioned, Representative, that the ability to inspect is the free way that people get access to data. And so we've heard some creative ways. Some people are doing virtual inspection where they do it over Zoom and they're showing the data. I think that some entities may still be accommodating socially distant in-person inspection, but we have advised that the obligation is still there. So they need to come up with creative ways to do that. Some of what we do is just provide the data for free. That's how we're doing it.
Any follow-up, Representative Hollins?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Herr. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two quick questions. One, just want to understand why the legislature is exempt from data practices. I mean, what is our rationale for why we exempt ourselves? And two, I understand that, there are some data practices policies that have been in existence for a long time, and how often do we look at them and update them? My specific question is really around public data. When a child is born to a married couple, that data is public. But when a child is married to a single mother, that data is confidential. And I'm just trying to, and I understand based on my own research and work I've done, that goes back a really long ways. And I'm just curious as to why we still separate that birth data in that way. And if there are any thoughts around updating it for the times that we are in now and not what we were trying to do back then with that particular data practices. So if you could help answer those two questions, that would be great.
Ms. Moxley Goldsmith.
I think actually those are two questions that are for the legislature to answer. Since the legislature sets the policy and passes the laws around what is public and what is not public, should the legislature be subject to the Data Practices Act, I think those are questions for the legislature to answer.
Any follow-up, Representative Herr?
No, I suspected that was the answer, and I was just curious if you could give me a background as to why that became the case, but that's fine. We can definitely have a conversation offline regarding these two things.
Yeah, I do know I can share that, interestingly, now, because he's one of our Supreme Court justices, but I know when he was Representative Paul Thiessen had some feelings about that, and he chose to make all of his emails publicly available. So I suppose members could choose to do that for themselves. We do have another question. Representative Scott.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to address Representative Herr's question in part, if I could. And then maybe that might be a question with Min Koji when they testify too as to the origins of some of this, because they've done like really deep dives, and some of the people in that organization were present when the Data Practices Act was written. So that might be a good question to ask them. And as far as the legislature, and they can elaborate on this more, but one of the things that is concerning is that they thought it might have a chilling effect on constituents actually contacting their legislator for various reasons. And the other reason would be that, you know, we have, we're the only government entity that has two kind of opposing parties, right? And so there's a lot of information that flows back and forth, amongst members of one caucus that does need to be protected in some way, right? You probably don't want every caucus email that your leadership sends out in the hands of Republican legislators and vice versa. So that was just a little bit of a clarification on why that probably came about. And again, Menkoji could probably elaborate a little bit more. Thank you, Pam.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Scott. That was, I think, helpful for people to be aware of. They've been long discussions for, you know, with different personalities throughout the years. And I think with that, I don't have any other questions. And so I'm going to ask staff to send out a link to that, the webinars that you mentioned and some of that other information and any other links that are shared with us throughout the rest of today's presentations. And with that, I think we will move on to the next presentation. And because we asked such succinct questions, we'll maybe have a little bit more time for questions with Menkoji. And so with that, we will move on to, so it's the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, but the acronym is Menkoji. And I wouldn't typically have a non-government agency doing a presentation at this point in the session, but I think that Menkoji plays an important role and has kind of a unique role to play when it comes to our data practices debates. And I'm sure they will be familiar faces for all of us as the session goes on. And so we did want to give that organization the ability to weigh in and introduce themselves and give a presentation today. So with that, Matt, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. Oh, you're muted.
How's that? Is that better?
That's better. Go ahead.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Matt Ealing. I'm a board member of Menkoji. We're an all-volunteer, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization focused on government data policy and open government issues. And so we're a group of attorneys and librarians, people who work in the media and communications like myself, and others who use government data and seek to preserve public access to that information. So during the legislative session, we're active as volunteers who follow data bills, and we help to support the policy aims of the Data Practices Act, particularly focused on its public access purpose. And this morning, I really want to talk briefly about the history of that act to help give background to its policy purposes. We feel that understanding the history of the Data Practices Act is important because it helps the legislature implement that act. And that duty has historically fallen to this committee and its partner committee in the Senate. Like many laws, the Data Practices Act arose to address a problem. And namely, for many years, it was quite difficult to access government records in the state of Minnesota. In 1941, the legislature passed the Official Records Act. This was a statute that mandated the retention and storage of government records, and it also had a short section on public access to those records. Now, that was a forward-looking law in 1941. There had not been a statute like that passed in the state to that point, but over time, a problem arose, and that problem was really the interface of the public access language in the statute and the way the Minnesota Supreme Court interpreted that language over time. And that really sort of constricted the scope of records that were available to the public. And that caused consternation, particularly among members of the press in the state. So people like St. Paul Pioneer Press editor John Finnegan, who was for many years turned away at the offices of government, or turned away from the doors of government offices, and he was frustrated with his ability to get access as a member of the press to government data, he convinced the Minnesota legislature, along with a number of others, to enact a new law with much more robust public access provisions. And that law was the Data Practices Act, and it created a really a far different legal framework than the one that existed previously. First and primarily, as you've heard from the Data Practices Office, the act established the legal presumption that all government data was accessible to the public unless the legislature passed a law saying otherwise. And so the law really made the legislature the primary actor in the management of government data, as opposed to city councils or school boards or executive branch agencies making classifications. So the legislature has exclusive control over the classification of government data. And I would note that historically that data management function and the role of ensuring public access to information has been championed by many legislators from both sides of the aisle, which we believe is really critically important since government data access is part of the bedrock of representative democracy and something that deserves bipartisan support. I want to just briefly turn your attention to how data classifications, how data classification determinations that are made by the legislature have downstream impacts on the public, the press, and on legislators too, who are treated as members of the public under the Data Practices Act. And I think that's not often discussed enough, that individual legislators, if they want to get information about what the government's up to, really have their recourse through the Data Practices Act. There's limited subpoena authority in some instances, but largely for individual legislators, that's how you find out about what's going on. So we would note, as you review bills that come before you, there's going to be a data classification section in many of those bills. And the way that language is constructed has major implications for our collective understanding of what the government is doing and how it operates. So if you look at page 2 of our handout, you'll see an example from last session that we think is instructive to sort of talk through these data classification issues. And this was a bill that this committee reviewed in an early version last year. It was a bill that moved in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, and it dealt with the allocation of $200 million worth of state loans and grants to hospitals and other providers for COVID mitigation steps. And members who were here last year will probably recall the bill and the issues that we raised about it at the time. If you look at the top of the page, you'll see the original data classification language in the statute made almost all loan and grant data collected by the commissioner of the Department of Health private or non-public data. And ultimately, under that original language, only 4 categories of data would have been publicly available, essentially a small amount of information that could have fit on a single spreadsheet, really. And that would have been the only public information collected by the department that would have been accessible, again, even to legislators. Other important data collected by the commissioner, such as memos or reports from the loan recipients, you know, data that documented the decisions about how and why the money was spent, would not have been available as public data. Now, the good news from our perspective is that members of this committee on both sides of the aisle worked on this last year, followed by the Senate, and eventually modified the final bill to afford greater public access. So if you look at the bottom of the page, you'll see the resulting data classification saying that all data collected by the commissioner was public, save for specific categories of proprietary business data about loan recipients. And so the net result was that the public, the press, and lawmakers now have a much greater ability to make data requests about this set of information and learn about how the program was implemented. And so this, we feel, is a really a useful example of how subtle changes in language can have major policy implications downstream. And we hope it provides you with a useful overview of some of the data issues that'll be facing you on this committee. Before I end, Madam Chair, I just want to pass on our organization's condolences to the family of Bob Shaw, who passed away earlier this week. Mr. Shaw was active with the Minnesota Newspaper Association for many years and was one of the people who was a prime mover of the Data Practices Act in its early days. So thank you for the time, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
All right, thank you. We do have a couple minutes for questions if members want to use the raise hand function. All right, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Well, Mr. Ealing, thank you for your presentation. And Minkoji has been extraordinarily helpful over the years. And the bill that you mentioned, your help was really invaluable. And I think newer members might not realize sometimes, you know, we're so busy with the other facets of a bill, we might not be focused on the data piece, and having extra eyes on it can be so helpful. The question I have for you is around the fact that there is nothing in law that I'm aware of that gives legislators any special ability to view data that members of the public don't have. And this has always struck me as a really interesting thing, because there are times, for example, let's take the bill we were just talking about, that law around this grant program. There might be a point at which legislators exercising their oversight might want to look at that proprietary data, and yet there's nothing in law that allows us to do that and gives us what would, I suppose, be the corollary obligation to keep that data private or a non-public if we were to do that. In other words, once data comes into my hands, it's public. I have no obligations to keep anything private. I wonder if you have any comment on that. Is that something that your organization's ever wrestled with? Is it something that you, I mean, just tell me if this is not a fair question. I'm just really interested in your opinion or your organization's opinion, whether there's a need or whether legislators should have a special access and the obligation to keep things at their original classification at times.
Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. It's a great question. In terms of the public policy value of having legislators and the public and the press kind of all on the same level, we think it provides an impetus to make sure that more data is public. Sometimes legislators play a key role in raising a question that needs to be answered in the legislature. Sometimes the press does. Sometimes individuals find out information that they then bring to the legislature. So we think it's good to kind of keep those folks on an even playing field in order to establish keep this public presumption in effect. In terms of the legislator or the legislature's role itself, I mean, there could be a way that there is a subpoena authority, additional subpoena authority granted through through statute. And certainly the OLA has subpoena authority, and legislators can currently bring questions about data that is not publicly available to the OLA, who can then provide summaries. So that's just some general high level response to you.
Follow-up, Representative Liebling?
No, that's a really, really interesting perspective that I had not thought about. So thank you very much for that answer.
All right, thank you. We don't have any other questions. So thank you, Mr. Ealing and Minkoji. I think that was really helpful to kind of make that first introduction to the committee. And I'm sure we can share contact information as well with members, and would encourage folks to take a look at the materials that were sent out. It was kind of funny, you held up a paper copy, but I don't know if everybody's printing their stuff off at home, but they could. maybe they have to pay for those copies, though. So thank you, Mr. Ealing, and I'm sure we will be seeing more of you as we go on this session.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, we will move on to our final presentation of the day, which is from the Department of Human Rights. Just want to, staff, if you can let me know that they're in the Zoom room, that would be helpful. Oh, I see the commissioner just popped up on my screen. So, okay. So we will get started. Commissioner Lucero, if you could introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. And is everyone able to hear me okay? Perfect. Okay, wonderful. So I'm going to start by sharing a presentation here that we can go through together. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I am the commissioner for the Department of Human Rights. And let me just all set here. Oops, there we go. Okay, great. So a little bit about myself that I just want to start out with. Welcome to those of you who are new to this committee. For those of you who have heard this before, thank you for your patience, and maybe this will prompt a new question. Let me start out by talking a little bit myself. So I am an attorney who practiced at Legal Aid doing consumer protection work, in private practice as an employment lawyer, and as an administrative law judge for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. About a decade ago, I focused my work more in public policy. Most recently, I worked at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity and at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits as a public policy director, working to support the thousands of nonprofits across the state. So this position is a perfect combination of my legal and policy work, and I'm deeply honored to do this work every day and appreciate the opportunity to talk about this agency with each of you today. So also joining us is Eric Ramankanki. He's the Government Relations Director, who I know many of you already know well. Before joining the agency in 2019, he worked at the Children's Defense Fund. And I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about our agency. So our vision is to create a world where everyone can lead lives full of dignity and joy. And that's because our mission is to make Minnesota discrimination-free. We feel making Minnesota discrimination-free is the floor. When Minnesota is free from discrimination, then we have then we are just following the minimum. Ultimately, at the end of the day, every single one of us are interested in building a strong community together. And that's why our vision comes into place, where we're creating this world together, where everyone can lead their lives full of dignity. So we are a small but mighty team here at this agency. We have about 45 full-time employees. Our budget is $10 million for the biennium. And the work that we do is in all 87 counties. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights is proud to be Minnesota's civil rights enforcement agency, enforcing a strong civil rights law here, here in Minnesota. Now, the foundation of our work is the Minnesota Human Rights Act. This act was passed into law in 1967, and it protects the civil rights of all Minnesotans in every county of the whole state. So this is an important time to be deeply dedicated to ending discrimination and creating a more equitable and inclusive state. As it's noted in the statute itself and quoted here, discrimination menaces the institutions and foundations of democracy. Minnesota's population is growing both older and more racially diverse. Across the board, Minnesota has some of the highest rates of racial discrimination in the country. This is true in housing, employment, education, and criminal justice system. Sexual harassment continues to be a pervasive problem. This is impacting children at school, employees, trying to provide for families across the state. And we are in a time where racism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, ableism, and misogyny remain pervasive throughout the country. So here in Minnesota, we can and must choose better. And in fact, we are required to choose better as part of statute. And we know that Minnesota is its best self when it's free from all forms of discrimination, be that ageism, ableism, or racism. Now, the act tasks the department with really three primary duties. First, with important enforcement duties in employment, housing, education, credit, and public accommodations or services based on protected classes such as race, religion, disability, national origin, sex, marital status, familial status, age, sexual orientation, and gender identity. The act further tasks the department to partner with and regulate thousands of state contractors across Minnesota to ensure men and women are compensated equally for equal work and to ensure that contractors are making good faith efforts to maintain inclusive and equitable workforces. Our third and last primary duty has to do with our education work to reduce discrimination and disparate outcomes. So I'm going to talk about each of these sections in turn. So first, the most common area of charge. So first, I want to talk about investigating and mediating charges of discrimination. Now, the most common area of charges of discrimination that are brought to our department are actually in one of three areas: disability, which makes a lot of sense as Minnesota is getting older. And so as we get older and we're in the workforce, we start needing more reasonable accommodations. Sex and sexual harassment, and also race. Depending on the month, one of those could be the higher of the month. But those are the three we see the most. Now, the areas we most commonly see charges brought far and away is in employment. We see some housing and some education cases as well, but overwhelming, the vast majority are in employment, which makes sense. That's where we spend a lot of our time. So I want to talk briefly through, well, what does the process look like? What happens when somebody calls our agency? So this is a slide that wasn't in your folder, but I have up here on the screen and is also on our website. And so this talks through the investigation and mediation process for a charge of discrimination. So let's say one of your constituents calls our office. They will speak to an investigator and they'll report what they believe to be discrimination. At that point, the investigator will talk them through and say, is this something that's covered or not? Now, if it is not covered, there is no charge of discrimination filed. So some things could not be covered, maybe because it's not in Minnesota. Maybe it's something that occurred in Missouri, or maybe it's something that happened several years ago. Also, there are some things that do not fit under our purview, but are things that are important to track. A great example of that are bias, or what some people might refer to as hate crimes, whether or not it's that under the law. And so let's say there's a swastika painted on somebody's garage that got tagged there. So those are incidents of bias or hate that we are tracking. And we do that for outreach, education, and policy change purposes, but do not result in a charge of discrimination. Of course, we always work to provide any resources to the individual if needed, or maybe there's another place that they should be talking to. So if something is covered by our agency, we work with the party who called us to file a charge of discrimination. At any point, the charging party and the respondent is able to choose to enter into mediation. And this is actually an area where we have spent a substantial amount of work over the past 2 years growing our department. And we're really excited about that work. And I believe on many of your schedules is an opportunity for us to do a deep dive into the mediation program later today. It's completely voluntary. And at any point, anyone, either the respondent or the charging party, can decide to go back and enter the investigation round. But if people are able to mediate, it's often just a really beneficial way for people to mutually come together around a solution. If a case goes back to investigation, an investigator conducts a neutral fact-finding investigation. That means they could interview witnesses, they can review documents, and make a determination and decide either there is probable cause of discrimination or there is not probable cause of discrimination. Of course, once we issue this determination, any party is able to appeal it. And if there is probable cause of discrimination, we may work to settle that case on behalf of the state. And so I'm going to provide three examples of where we did find probable cause of discrimination to kind of give you a purview of some of the work that we do. So the first one here, this is Laura. This is Laura and her service animal. Laura works for an employer who repeatedly denied her the opportunity to work with her service animal as was needed for her disability. And so in this situation, we did an investigation and we did find that there was probable cause of discrimination. We entered into a settlement agreement and we required the company to change their policies and undergo some training, and also pay Laura for her lost wages and damages. A second example here is about Jamisha. Now, Jamisha she worked in a senior living facility. And she is a Black woman who works with one resident in particular who would regularly racially harass her. So for instance, this woman would consistently use the N-word against her, would make comments about her Black skin color and speak disparagingly about her Black skin. Jamisha would report this to her supervisor regularly. Not only did nothing change, but her supervisor said it was just something that she needed to get used to and deal with. At the end of the day, the senior living facility ultimately fired Jamisha. We investigated this charge of discrimination and found probable cause and worked to settle this. And again, in this situation, the settlement agreement required the employer to address and prevent further racial discrimination through trainings and also updates to policies and procedures. And then, of course, pay Jamisha for lost wages and damages. The third example that I'll talk to you about is about a sexual assault that occurred to a 16-year-old in the workplace. Now, this 16-year-old was sexually assaulted by her supervisor. She was a lifeguard, and he took her to a closed beach where he assaulted her. He then drove her in a county vehicle to purchase Plan B emergency contraceptives. She actually reported this a couple times to two supervisors, and neither took action. Now, she was 16 at the time. She came back the following summer to work, and she was again assigned to work with that same supervisor who had assaulted her. She reported it a third time, and it was finally the third supervisor who acted. And so the settlement agreement here, once we found a probable cause of discrimination, required the county to update its policies. Because of course, sometimes bad things do happen, but it's really on those who are in positions of power to act quickly to respond in these situations. And so there needs to be a very strong sexual harassment policy in place, and people need to act on that and address it once it is reported. So the training came with, again, a change to policies and trainings. And I hope, again, you're hearing in all three of these examples, kind of the systems change work that goes on in this, where we're looking at both changes to policies and procedures and changes to training to prevent this from even happening again in the future. That's the proactive work that's part of this. I'm going to talk about our second area of work, which is the equity and inclusion for state contracting. As I mentioned, we work with contractors on state-funded projects to intentionally create career opportunities for Black and Indigenous communities, communities of color, and women. This has been part of statute since, I think, 1987, when legislators said, hey, if we're going to be investing in our community and spending money and resources on our community, let's make sure we're doing it with intention. Later on, under WISA, it was also added that our responsibility is to ensure that employers are paying men and women the same for the same job. So a really good example of this is the work in the partnership between the department and J.E. Dunn on the Capitol Restoration Project, which there's a picture of there. So this is actually one of the largest recent construction projects in Minnesota. And on the project, the company exceeded the workforce participation goals with 35% people of color and 21% for women. Now, J.E. Dunn partnered with local nonprofits to bring more people of color and women into the industry on the project. And I think one of the things that's really important to note is what happened afterwards. So after the project was finished, J.E. Dunn, because of their work on retention, was able to keep these employees beyond the project. So more than 80% are still in the trades today. So this project, this state project did more than renovate a historic building, but it helped bring historically disenfranchised communities into well-paying careers. So this is a perfect example of how being intentional matters. It makes a difference. The third area of our work and has actually, to do with education.
Actually, Commissioner, because we're ahead of schedule a little bit, I'm going to take a couple questions that have popped up so we don't get too far down the line. Representative Feist.
Thank you. My question is, I know that there are a lot of federal laws that also prohibit discrimination. And I'm talking with colleagues about possible state laws that specifically prohibit discrimination based on national origin. And I guess my question is kind of how does the federal law, federal anti-discrimination laws, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and then individual bills interact? Like, is the purpose of an individual bill to create additional causes of action and maybe additional more specific definitions? I'm just trying to understand kind of what the role of a separate anti-discrimination provision would be at the state level when we've already got these other layers of laws that prohibit national origin discrimination and any type of discrimination.
Commissioner.
Great. Chair Becker-Finn, Representative, I thank you so much for that question. Yeah, so at the federal level, the federal government does say what are the anti-discrimination laws at that level. Here in Minnesota, we have said for the past 50 some years that we want to ensure that in Minnesota, we do not have discrimination here as well. So actually in many places, the Minnesota law goes beyond the federal laws. And I think that's important because Minnesota gets to decide what is the world that they want to create here in Minnesota. And so here in Minnesota, we do protect national origin under our Minnesota Human Rights Act. So that is protected already under our statute. And if anyone feels like they've been discriminated against under national origin, they're welcome to reach out to our agency. Now, in terms of kind of that partnership between state and federal, we do work directly with the EEOC on cases that have to do with employment. And so, which is, as I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of our cases. So when somebody files a charge of discrimination with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, that is considered cross-files with the EEOC, and we work with them on that. And oftentimes, if people were to bring their own private right of action, they would bring it under state and federal, but they would have the choice of whether or not they would like to do so. And as I mentioned, there are many places where only the state protects folks.
Follow-up, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize, I think I forgot to say Madam Chair the first time. Still learning the protocols. I do have a follow-up question. So I have a better understanding of how federal law intersects with the Minnesota Human Rights Act, but I'm curious, are there instances in state law where we have additional specificity in terms of anti-discrimination laws and what role those laws could play? Because I'm specifically in conversations with colleagues about a specific bill that could create additional protections for against national origin discrimination. And I'm curious, is that redundant or is there a role to be played? And I think specifically, would that be around damages or specificity? Sorry, this is kind of a big question, but I guess it's more like the MHRA, Minnesota Human Rights Act, and other specific state level anti-discrimination bills that I'm curious about. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair, Representative, thank you very much. So I think what might be the most helpful is for us to speak offline in more detail about what it is that you're looking at, because our statute does already protect national origin. And so it sounds like there's maybe some additional things that you're thinking at. And so let's meet about that and talk a little bit more to see what those interplays are and what may not already be covered, if that's okay.
All right, thank you. Next, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How are you, Commissioner Lucero? Very good.
I'm doing good, thank you.
Hey, my question is, so I've been on the end of as a respondent, and also I've been on the end as the filing charges for employees. And my question is, I know that in the past there has been a backlog of cases. And I know we've had some we've had an OLA report that talked about that. Can you talk about things that the department has put in place now to catch up and meet its mandatory requirement to give a decision or conclusion within that year, within a 1 year period?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Chair Becker-Finn, Representative, thank you so much. So yeah, the OLA report, I'm really glad that you brought that up because the OLA report kind of came out right before the pandemic hit last year and it all got lost in all of that insanity that we've been up against. So the OLA report, I think, does a really good job highlighting all of the changes that needed to be put in place and that our agency has put in place to make sure our processes can be the most efficient and effective as possible. the OLA report rightly confirms what you're saying right there, that the department has for many years had a backlog of cases. These are complicated cases, and it does take a while to do them and do them correctly. And as I started this whole presentation out, we are a very small agency. So we have about 14 investigators who are responsible for hundreds and hundreds of cases that come in every single year. So the amount of time it takes to investigate a charge does negatively impact every party involved. We're aware of that. It doesn't provide the timely relief for people who have been harmed by violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And for respondents, there's often a gap of several months before we reach out to respondents to do that interview or initial response, which causes memories to fade or even not even a lack of awareness about documentation that may be needed to be kept. So this is a great concern to me and my team here. And this is an area that we have put a lot of work into. So we have, I think there's three areas that I'll specifically highlight for you. First and foremost, the intake process itself has been strengthened substantially. So we want to make sure that the right cases are coming in and that we're not bringing in cases that we shouldn't be spending any time on. So all of those charges of discrimination are reviewed to make sure that they are that they're in the right place, that we can actually take them and we have jurisdiction over them. Second, we have also implemented and strengthened our mediation process. That's an area where we weren't spending a lot of time, and it was really more administrative. And in the past 2 years, we've built that quickly. That is a way to resolve cases early on and get them off of the books if it makes sense for all parties involved. It's having a great success rate. In 2012, when the party started, the percentage of cases that were settling through mediation, the success rate for that mediation was about 35%, and now we're at 75%, and so it's working. And then the third area that we've spent a lot of time is increasing the, making sure that the determinations themselves are high quality and easier to use for every single investigator. So right now there is a standard determination that has regularly updated law for every area of the law. So if it's an employment case around sexual harassment, if it's a employment case around age discrimination, the law is already there and it can quickly put in the facts and the situation to move that through. So these changes are working. We're getting cases done faster, more effectively, and more efficient. And we still have a capacity problem. So both are true. And we are doing everything we can to control our part of it, the process part of it, while recognizing that we have cases coming in. You will see in your legislative report that comes out that we've had an increase, a 10% increase in the number of charges that have come in, and a substantial increase in the number of calls overall, both because of reasonable accommodations due to COVID and some anti-Asian rhetoric that started the COVID pandemic out pretty strongly there, which again takes away. So we're continuing to do this work. You're going to continue to see that backlog.
Follow-up, Representative Frazier.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm glad to hear about the efficiencies that you put in place. And I'm also really glad to hear that the mediation process is that more people are engaging in it. I know that wasn't the case in years past, so I'm glad to hear that. You got to what I think my follow-up was going to be is, were you seeing any trends due to COVID? But I think you touched on that, so I won't ask anything further. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We'll do one more question because I want to make sure the commissioner can finish her presentation, but I know this question is related to something she just covered. So Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I was just curious, as you were giving the examples of some of the cases your office has investigated, how the Human Rights Act and the work you do intersects with both criminal investigations that might be happening, like, for example, the lifeguard case was clearly that was a crime also, and then any civil action that a person might seek through the civil courts. Just curious how all those things work together.
Commissioner.
I'm Chair Becker Finn, Representative Moeller. Thanks for that question. Yeah, oftentimes there are many pieces that can intersect together. So we have no jurisdiction or oversight into any criminal proceeding. However, we always encourage anyone who thinks that they may be the victim of a crime to contact the police, be that a hate crime that they're alleging, or for instance, in that that one specific case. Now, in that case, there actually was a criminal charge in that case, and the person who committed the sexual assault was spending time in jail. Now, we're not looking at the criminal side of things, however, we're looking at what did the employer do and how did they act. When those reports came in, they did nothing. When a second report came in, they did nothing. It wasn't until the third report a year later that something happened. And that's what we're focused on, is the policies and procedures change. If somebody decides to move forward with an additional civil proceeding, they're able to do so. And we are not involved in that either. We stick very much to the human rights statute itself.
Any follow-up, Representative Moeller?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, and Commissioner, if you could finish your presentation, and then if we have time, we'll take a couple more questions.
Sure, and I will actually go quick because I would love to hear any questions and welcome any offline conversations as well. So the last area that we work is really about educating to reduce discrimination and disparate outcomes. And so we work with individuals and communities, employers across the state. The ones that I think I'll mention quickly is the Human Rights Commissions, because a lot of cities and counties across the state have their own Human Rights Commissions. Only a few have enforcement capabilities. That's Minneapolis, St. Paul. And so we have the enforcement capabilities over the entire state. And these commissions are on the ground doing powerful work within their communities every single day. So we want to do everything we can to support them. Let's see. A couple areas of additional work that we work on is ban the box for employers. That's per statute, and that's for private employers. We do a lot of interagency work, as listed here, children's cabinet, housing work, both for the Interagency Council on Homelessness and Olmstead, and then the Community Resiliency and Recovery Work Group when it comes to COVID, which is a really nice transition to COVID. That I will mention, actually, one trend that I want to actually state is that 10% of the calls that we've received around COVID are actually related to anti-Asian bias and discrimination. And when you consider that the population for Asian Americans in Minnesota is, 2-3%, for 10% of our calls to be there, we see a clear problem. And so we've been talking to a lot of community groups about that, doing education. As we get the vaccine and folks start going back to school and to the workplace, this is something for us to keep an additional eye on. Our agency, I am proud to report, has been able to transition to doing work from home as quickly as possible. It was March 12th of 2020. We were in full operation. There are a few areas that we do quite a bit of work when it comes to COVID. It's already built into the work that we do within our agency. The biggest one there has to do with reasonable accommodations. There's a lot of folks who maybe haven't had to think about disability or asks of reasonable accommodation before, and for the first time ever having to look at that and make those requests. Employers too have been incredibly creative and flexible with what is possible, kind of blowing all of our minds of what's possible. This has been a time of great change. And so working with employers to encourage that creativity. And as COVID ends, continuing down that path of creative, reasonable accommodations. We also work alongside other agencies to provide information on housing and worker protections. So for instance, you aren't allowed to evict somebody because of fear or stigma around COVID, a question that was coming up early in COVID very quickly. If, for instance, somebody was a truck driver and was driving in parts of the country where there was higher rates of COVID, could you keep them from their housing if they lived in an apartment complex? No, cannot do that. So we were able to provide some of that assistance and information. I just really want to thank everyone for their time, and I stand for any questions.
All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Commissioner Lucero. I really appreciate your time. My question is regarding the examples that you gave. Obviously, really great examples, clear-cut understanding of discrimination in all of those. I did intern at the Department of Civil Rights in Minneapolis, and so I know that not all of the situations that come in are quite so clear-cut. And in my experience, a lot of the times employers or any person who is doing the discrimination is often not purposefully discriminating, but just happens to not really know or understand what the rules are around that. And I'm just wondering if there's any follow-up that your department does for folks that maybe don't rise to the level of discrimination, but also could use some education in this area.
Commissioner.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Hollins, thank you so much for your question. First and foremost, intention is really, you know, not something that we spend so much time on. It's about the impact that we're always asking. Does the impact here rise to the level of discrimination under the law? And if so, we're able to implement some of those systems change, the training and the policy systems that, regardless of your intent, are having this impact. So let's work on that together. Now your question is, okay, well, what about for all those folks where it maybe doesn't quite rise to the level? And I think that really gets at our vision itself, where our mission is to make Minnesota discrimination free, but our vision is something more than that. And that is why the education and outreach component of the statute is really important. So we have a full-time staffer who goes around doing trainings on what are civil rights in Minnesota, into that area right there that you're talking about. This is an area with where we would love the opportunity to do a lot more education, training, and outreach. I also make myself available regularly to employers or landlords to do lots of presentations and conversations about this. We provide in those trainings lots of best practices, or I don't really like the term best practices, practices that will lead to a decrease of discrimination and at the end of the day, just lead to a more inclusive and welcoming Minnesota across the board. Our workforce is more productive, is more happy. Our community is just beaming with joy when we can all show up to our work and be in our housing as our authentic selves. And so that is very much in the trainings that I provide. We would love to do more.
Any follow-up, Representative Hollins?
No, Chair. Thank you so much.
And with that, we don't have any additional questions. I know that the commissioner and her staff are available outside of this meeting for follow-up. If people want to get more information, I would encourage folks to check out the website, too. I know there's a lot of information there. And with that, I know that time is the one resource that is always limited for all of us. So maybe this will mean folks can get a second cup of coffee this morning. So we're gonna wrap up for the day, and we'll be back on Thursday. Our agenda for Thursday is the Guardian Ad Litem, Uniform Laws Commission, and Judicial Standards. So stay tuned for more exciting presentations here in the Judiciary Finance Committee. And with that, we are adjourned.